Okay. Good morning. So, last year, I finally got around to writing a series on something that's been bothering me for a while, or for just I've been thinking about for a long time, which is the following. Halacha reflects and instructs on every aspect of life. So if there's an aspect of life that has been radically changed, then halacha needs to respond and needs to integrate that reality as it formulates instructions for the new world. And one of the most significant changes in the modern world, and modern here can mean 500 years, mean 300 years, depending on where you want to sort of pick your starting point, has been the ever quickening pace of mass communication, of instant communication, right? It started really with transportation and postal services, and then became the telegraph and the phone, and now it's internet and social media, and take your pick. But that changes the way that we experience life. It changes the way we have friendships, right? Parents, grandparents can Skype with their grandkids, even if they're thousands of miles away. I'm traveling now from Israel. I can talk to my wife on my phone. Right? Just like, 10, 15 years ago when I was maybe 15, 20 years ago, when I was like a kid, they had spy kids, and that was like the cool technology that they had, and now everyone has it on their phone. It changes everything that we do, the way we think about things. We know it's shaped political movements, right? So much has been written of how social media shaped the election of President Trump, whatever you think of him, Brexit, whatever you think of that. But these things have changed the way we experience our relationships, politics, everything in life. So last year I finally sat down to write a series on halacha in the age of social media. Right? How has halacha changed? And today I want to study just one topic that I covered, but I think it is typical in highlighting the types of problems, the types of issues that need to be asked in the modern world. So what I want to do is focus on the mitzvah of tzedakah, but specifically the following principle. Many halachot are seemingly geography-based. And tzedakah, as we'll see, one of the guiding principles is that when you are choosing how to allocate your funds, your inner concentric circles are yourself, your family, and then aniyei ircha, the poor of your city. Which, if I asked you thousands of years ago, who are the poor of your city, there was only one answer. The answer was the poor of your city. Right? This is not like, right, if you think of Fiddler on the Roof, okay? Right? The people in Anatevka had been in Anatevka their entire lives, their parents' entire lives, their grandparents' entire lives. So when they leave, they sing this mournful song, and the movie starts with them talking about how everyone has their role. You like them, you don't like them, but that's your community, right? This is who you have to get along with, because this is where you've been, this is where you will be for the foreseeable future, right? And they have no idea what it means to not be an Anatevka, right? Hence that, what is it, the last 5 minutes of the movie, where many of them are moving to America, and two of them turn to each other, where are you going? New York, where are you going? Chicago. Oh, so we'll be neighbors, right? They have no, right? You know this scene, right? They have no concept, right? Geography was the way you experienced life. The notion that there was a big world out there was, right, it was basically irrelevant, right? It's like you read these fascinating pieces in the Balei HaTosfot, where they say, we have serious problems. We can't have weddings in our cities because there's not a single person in the city who is kasher le'edos for anybody else because we're all related, right? Like, this is, right, this is the world you're living in. And then suddenly, transportation gets easier, right? And each stage, people think this is a quantum leap, and it was, right? But there was a time when, you know, railroads were the quantum leap, right? And suddenly, mail and information could be transferred in only a week, or only 2 weeks, or only a month. And then you had planes. But now we know you can, right? Now global politics is run on Twitter, right? Right? It's a So how do you define community in that world? Right? How do you define community in that world? That's the question I want to ask. Okay? So I'll throw out the question to you in a minute. Let's just prove the source, prove from the sources that this is the question we need to ask. Okay? So we started. Are there more? Yeah, there's a few more over here. Okay. So we'll start with the pasuk. This isn't just about staka, it's really about many different acts of chesed, but the Torah tells us, number one, im kesef talver amir ani imach lo tiyeh lo chenoshe lo tusimun alav neshech. If you lend money to your friends, so, to your brother rather, to my nation, don't be like a creditor to him, right? Don't charge rivis, don't charge interest. And Chazal understand that this is one of the places where im is not an option, im is an instruction. You have to lend money. It is a mitzvah to lend money. It is related to the mitzvah of staka, probably an even more primary mitzvah of staka in Torah itself, right? According to the Rambam, this is a higher level of staka than what we call staka, than charity. So who do you give this to, right? This is, so the Gemara in number 2, in Bava Metzia, Ayin Aleph, tells you, the Tani of Yosef, im kesef talveh erami en ani imach. What do we learn from this principle of ami, right? He picks up on two words, ami, my nation, and probably the next one is imach, with you. Right, so what are the guiding principles? So he says, ami v'nochri, ami kodem. If the choice is between a Jew and a non-Jew, you give precedence to lending money to a Jew. Aniv Ashir, if it's a poor person or a rich person, right? The rich person, I assume, needs money for capital to open a new company, but it's not for basic needs. And a poor person who needs money maybe to buy his one plow so that he can work for that season or for food or whatever it might be, Ani Kodem, give to the poor person. Aniyecha v'aniyei ircha. If the choice is between the poor, your poor, and the poor of your city, presumably the poor of your family, the poor of your household, or the poor of your city, aniyecha kodmin, so your inner concentric circle goes before those of your city. Aniyei ircha v'aniyei iracheret. Aniyei ircha kodmin. If the choice is between the poor of your city and the poor of another city, so the poor of your city take precedence. The Gemara in Bava Metzia, number 3, tells you that the same is true of classic charity. Classic tzedakah. Pasach, tiftach, ein li ela l'aniyei ircha. Right? Here it's even more striking. It says, I know that you have to give money to the poor of your city. L'aniyei iracheret minayin. How do I know, not just that I give precedence to, but that I have any obligations to the poor outside of my city? Talmud Lomar Badoch Tiftach, because it says you shall surely open Mikol Makom, which means no matter what. Naton Titen Eliya Matanam Rubem Matanam Muetet Minayin Talmud Lomar Naton Titen Mikol Makom. And how do I know that even if you can only provide a little bit, you have to do that? Because you shall surely open your hand. But here the Gemara seems to be even more striking, right? There is a Hava Mina. The Gemara entertained the possibility that your only obligation of charity is to those in your city. And if you skip for a moment to number 5, the Chavetz Chaim in his Sefer Avot Chesed argues that this principle of Aniyei Ircha and all related rules is not just about staka, classically understood, it's not just about charity, it's not just about the mitzvah of lending. This is a principle in all acts of Chesed. In all acts of Chesed, when you have limited resources, whether those resources be money, time, whatever the resources may be, but you have limited resources. So he writes, Kol dinei hakdima nemar lamala ulav dafka al halfa'av shel kelim du adin al izashum tova acheret. It's not just true of lending money, of lending objects, of tzedakah, it's true of everything. This is the principle in chesed. Okay, so let's outline the principles we have. There are really two principles, and how they interact is quite complicated, and unfortunately we cannot do everything, so we're going to have to focus on one. One principle of tzedakah is you give to the person who needs it more. Right? We saw that already in the Gemara. Poor, rich, give to the poor person the loan rather than the rich person. The second principle is that, assuming, let's understand it for a moment the way the Panim Yafot does, assuming need is equal, or basically equal, so then you judge based on the relation of that person to you. Okay? So now let me ask you, why is this true? And then once we say, why is that true? Maybe we'll be able to figure out how that principle will be expressed in a world in which the reality on the ground is fundamentally different. So why is it true that when allocating funds or allocating resources, you start with your family? By the way, who do you do before your family?
Yourself.
Yourself, thank you. I won't read it inside, but as the poskim note, Regmar and Baba Metzia, since we poskim Rebbe Akiva against Ben Petora, Rebbe Akiva and Ben Petora dispute. If your two people are walking in the desert, you only have enough water for one person to survive. Do you divide it so neither of them has to let the other one die, or does one person take it? Ben Petora says, share the water and don't live at someone else's expense. Rebbe Akiva says, no, you always have the right / obligation to survive yourself. And the poskim assume this is true in staka as well, right? If you are poor, don't start giving staka. That's a bad idea, right? You're already in debt, right? And again, you're already in debt, and now, right, you take out another loan at a higher interest to help somebody else, right? And now you have to pay back that, right? You know, this is not a situation you want to be in. But why is this true, right? Why do we allocate resources based on our concentric circles?
Starting from yourself, before you can help somebody else, you have to be in the position to help somebody else, maybe. So that's
so for yourself, right? That makes sense. But why? And maybe for your family, that makes sense. But why do you start in your city, right? You could help people in the other city, even if the people in your city,
because you feel most affinity.
Okay, good. Right. So I'm going to be very careful here. One possibility is that it's about who do you feel connected with. Now, why is that important?
Then it's more meaningful. Maybe.
So maybe it's more meaningful. Right, maybe it's more meaningful, right? Or maybe even more, it's, right, maybe that feeling of closeness actually has moral weight, right? Meaning, it feels like I should be giving you, and therefore, since, right, the Torah is meant to respond to and develop empathy, right, and people I'm connected to, I actually owe more to, right? Now, family's an interesting case, right, because maybe I owe them more whether or not that feeling is there. It might be an objective claim that you should feel more for them. Though the poskim aren't sure about that, right? The poskim entertain the possibility that like a sibling that you're not close to, and a close friend, your friend might come first. So there is a moral element to this, right? That the people in your inner concentric circle, you actually owe more to, right? If anyone has studied Adam Smith, not Wealth of Nations, right? Not his book on economics, but his other book, on ethics, the theory of moral sentiments, you'll see that that's basically his argument, that the people in your inner concentric circles, you owe not just justice, but sort of what we would call in modern English benevolence, but he calls beneficence. But the difference between those I won't get into, but fundamentally you owe more, right? Meaning Adam Smith, the father of capitalism, who thinks you only owe people, right, justice, you just have to be honest in business, but then after that you can be in it for your own self-interest, says when it comes to your family, that's not true. You owe your family more than that. You owe them beneficence. You owe them kindness. So there's a moral dimension to this, right? Why else might you give the poor in your city first?
They're in front of you.
Good. There might be simply a question of responsiveness, right? Is that staka is an obligation which is driven in a certain sense by responding to a need at hand. And those in your inner circle, right, are... the need is at hand, right? There's a obligation not just to sort of in a vacuum just allocate funds, but to respond to that which is right in front of you. And that's for sure true, right, as we'll see. Why else? We're all getting very conceptual, right? What?
No, shipping charges. Those stamps add a lot of money.
Good. So let's just call that practical, right? It could just be practical, right? Like, if you divide it, right, it's easier to give to the people closer. It makes sure that people don't get, right, that people know where to turn, right? Right, they know where to turn, right? Who is supposed to give me tzedakah? Whoever, right, lives near me. That's where I'm going to go. That's it, right? And we know, right, it could just be practical. If everyone takes care of their own, so then that's the best, right, the best system.
Also, poverty in the community has a ripple effect.
Correct, right, could be, right, there could be a self-preservation component to it, right? It's better to live in a... Good. So now let me pose the question. Okay? Now, Okay. So let me pose the question as follows. Fine. So this is true in a world where it's very clear what it means to be the poor of your city. But now I ask you a question. Okay. What is the real principle there, right? It used to be that, again, the people you affiliated with were the people in your city. So if I asked you, what is a community, right? You could say, right? If I asked you, what's a community? So it used to be you'd say, the people who live near me, the people that I see on Shabbos, the people that I interact with, the people I do business with, the people I learn with, the people I daven with, etc. And all of those people would probably be overlapping. But now if I ask you, what happens when that's not the reality? Right? The people who live next door to me are not necessarily the people I talk to every day, or do business with, or identify with. Right? Who has a claim to my funds first? Or let me put it the way Rav Yehuda Zolden does in a recent article in Sohar. Okay? You live in a modern Orthodox community. Okay? And you are proudly modern Orthodox. You are an alumnus of YU, right? You have been supporting YU your whole life. Let's put it that way, okay? And next door to you, you live somewhere where real estate is reasonable. So a Haredi Kolel who, let's take it as extreme as possible, because, okay, a Neturei Karta Kolel opens next door to you, right? Okay, next door to you, and then it's the week before Rosh Hashanah, and everyone's raising money, and they knock on your door, and they say, I noticed that you were, you have a YU flag, you know, bumper sticker on your car. I know you're probably thinking about giving to your alma mater before Bar Hashanah, but you know, you live in, take your city, I don't know, pick a city, right? You live in, not in Washington Heights, okay? That's not your local charity. We are your local charity, we get it, you hate us, right? You don't believe the same thing as us, but you know, we are Ani Yircha, right? You owe us, don't give to them, whatever money you're planning on giving to YU. Right? Please redirect to the Neturei Karta, right, Yizkor Fund. Okay? So now, is that legitimate? Right? Is that legitimate? Is that what Ani Ircha would dictate? And now you gotta ask, what was the real principle? Was Ani Ircha really geographic or not? So, we've thrown out some possibilities of why Ani Ircha get precedence. So now, someone tell me, okay, what do you think? Intuitively, what do you think?
Why you all the way?
Well, no, good, why you all the way? Right, on, Rabbi Dr. Based, Berman would be very proud. Based, good, good, right?
If it's based on who you feel a connection with, then you could say it's why you. If you could say it's based on practicality, then the Neturei Karta might have a claim to say, we're right here, it's practical to give to us, it's not, you know, doing whatever you're doing. If it's based on the Tzorech, you might also, the Neturei Karta people might say we're starving, and they might also have a claim. So it really depends on whether you feel
good.
It's based
right,
on
so this
connectivity.
Is, right, so this is the question it comes down to, right? Is if you think that Ani Ircha meant those in your geographic area, then they might really have a claim. But if you think that really Ani Ircha never meant those people close to you, it meant your community. Elamai, it used to be your community was everyone close to you. But in a world where there's not true, so then your obligation is to those who you identify with. Now, anyone want to... Those are the two possibilities. Anyone want to give me a third possibility, a mixed possibility? Or yeah?
I would argue the reverse, in that it's a higher level of giving when you're giving to your community that you're currently living with, that you don't particularly have an affinity for. Maybe you just moved in there and you'd rather give to YU or to synagogue 1,000 miles away that you lived in for 20 years. So it seems like... a higher level of giving when you're not connected.
Right, so you could argue, right, that maybe you should, right, the benefit, well, let me put it a little bit differently, right? What you're saying is, maybe the reason, right, what we've said so far is that maybe the reason to give to your community was because of identity, right, social ties. Maybe it was because of geography, or maybe we chose geography because that ensures that you give to the people not just because you feel like it, but because it's the right thing to do, right? Now, I think there's a lot to that, but let's play with this a little bit, okay? So far, we've raised two possibilities. Either it's all about social identity lines, ideological lines, or all about geography, right? But I gave the particular example I gave is...
Extreme example.
What?
It was an extreme example.
Well, it's an extreme example, but it's also an interesting example because I sort of pulled a fast one there. It is the example Reisolden gives, but I pulled a bit of a fast one, right? Yeah. Good, is that I swallowed up a lot of different types of stucco there, right? I talk about institutions. Does anyone want to give me a logical argument for why we might distinguish between, let's call institutional fundraising, and old Tomchei Shabbos, let's say, okay? Right, poor people.
The Torah was talking about supporting individuals. That's what the Torah is talking about. Mossad, such as a kollel, is not strictly speaking, well, they try to say it, but it's not strictly speaking necessarily part of the community in the normal sense, because they're getting people from who come out. I mean, in many cases, you have a kollel, and they'll bring in people from other places to simply set up a makom of learning, but they're not individuals in the sense that the Torah said when we were speaking about these psukim.
Right. Okay, so one possibility to distinguish is to say that one of these is real stucca, and the other we call it stucca, but it's not really stucca, it's like Talmud Torah, right? It's like something else. It's like in the realm of Tzai, we're not really stucca, right? I think that one of my students, yeah.
You told me to vet out the pranksters, and you were not able to do that.
Okay, good. So let's... Good, right? So now Tomchei Shabbos obviously has a certain advantage in that sense. I think there's also another element here, which is, besides this question of is this formally stucca, is it something else, there's also a really important moral difference, I think, right? Which is the following, right? Yeah.
I'm sorry, just what you haven't addressed so far is discretion. You know, like what you've done so far is you've laid out a hierarchy of you know, shalach and in the area, you know, whatever. But this also an element of discretion.
Correct, and we will get back to the question of discretion. But so far, let's try to figure out the guiding principles that the Torah wants to give us. We'll see that it's not exclusive, right? Okay, yeah.
You mentioned an interesting term of modern orthodoxy. However, if I ask you in the title where it says that, if you'll find it, it's at the Yuma in Basim, but you learn that it's in Karmai Chaim or Salamos. So in Parsha Shaykh, in the term where you learn about the halachas of tzedakah, you can simplify it that you give, of course, if you need it, to yourself and your family, and then to your community, and then to the world at large. Also, another thing, the Thomas are excellent, super, very different, but you didn't mention the division between fixed principles of tzedakah and Meiser Tzedakah, which we find in the Choshen Mishpat Kuf Mem Vav here.
Yeah, so there are differences, right? Meaning, right, there is a certain, so there is a certain overlap here, right? Now, right, it tends to be that the poskim assume that the principle of Meiser Tzedakah are, for practical purposes, very similar to those of tzedakah, for the simple reason that Meiser may have its own rules, but Meiser Ksafim, the majority of poskim assume, like the Bach in Reish Nun Zayin, that it is a minhag, right? And therefore, it basically takes the form of tzedakah because it's not an independent institution. And within that model, the assumption is that the rules of the allocation of Meiser Ksafim is going to be similar to that of classic tzedakah. But there's a difference, I think, that one of my students pointed out, and I think is 100% true. And tell me if this resonates with you, and then we'll see whether we can see this in poskim, okay? Institutional tzedakah, I'll put it as sharply as I can. Institutional tzedakah, what justifies giving to an institution? That people believe in it, right? Meaning, if there's an institution that no one believes in, it shouldn't exist. It doesn't matter where it is, right? Like, that's the nature of institutional charities, right? Yeah, you'll have cases on the border, right? Everyone believes in it, right? This school, but it's in a poor area, right? Right, that no one's supporting it, but not because no one believes in it. But, like, fundamentally, institutions gain their credibility, right? And the reason they should be supported is because they have a vision that people believe in.
Right.
But poor people, right? So institutions, I would be happy to say that ani yircha mean the institutions you identify with. Who wants to put their name behind the claim that the only people who deserve tzedakah right? Like, food on their table are the people who have a well-set-up social network to support them, right? Meaning, who are the people who need staka the most, right? The people who don't have those ties, right? It could be that the reason that Ani Yerchad exists in classic staka is... Sorry, what was your name from the back?
My name's Sai.
What Sai said, which is poor people, right? If we force you to give to the people close to you, then we make sure that the people who don't have friends and family get supported, right? Meaning there's a reason for it to be geographic and not about connection, because the people who need support the most are the people with no connections. Institutionally, maybe not, right? So it could be that we have to ask, what type of stuck are you talking about? Is it stuck that makes sense to redefine along identity lines? Or is it stuck that, right, there's reason to, at a certain level, impose obligations, right? Even that, right, I don't necessarily logically feel for, right? Okay. So, let's try to analyze. Yeah.
You mentioned about Aniyei Shalayim, but
good. We're gonna get to that. We're gonna get to that in a second. Okay. In number 8 and 9, we will get to it in 1 second. Okay. So let's look for a moment to 7. Now, I wanted to show you how strong these principles are because who was it who said discretion, right? So what's your name?
Dave.
But Dave said about discretion. Okay. What we see in staka is, in fact, that there's limited discretion, right? Because everything that I've said now assumes that you don't have full discretion. And I'm willing to put my name behind that. You don't have full discretion. Because, let me show you how much you don't. Okay? Sivchet in Reish Nun Zayin says as follows. Ani sheyesh lo krovim ashirim sheyacholin lefarnaso. The halacha is as follows. Let's say a poor person who has wealthy relatives. Ein gabay ha'ir chayavin lefarnaso. We so impose these principles, right? If someone has a wealthy uncle, the Tomchei Shabbos in the area does not have to give the poor person money because the wealthy relative is expected, right, to support his relative. And then Shulchan Aruch goes farther. Afal gav de krov gamkein no nikis. Even if, right, that wealthy uncle is the primary supporter for Tomchei Shabbos, right? He gives $1 million a year to Tomchei Shabbos, and he says, listen, I have a poor relative I'd like you to give to Tomchei Shabbos. Halachically, the head of Tomchei Shabbos can turn to him and say, I'm sorry, but I know you can afford another $10,000, right? You have to give your nephew $10,000 plus the million that you're giving to Tomchei Shabbos, right? That's how much we actually don't give you full discretion. We expect, right? These obligations are, right? Right, that's really a wild, right? That's a wild halacha when you think about it, right? That we so expect that the relative, you have to give to your relatives, that if he exists, there exists a wealthy relative, even if he supports the communal institutions, the communal institutions are justified in saying, right, that's very nice, I'm very happy you gave us $1 million, but we're going to use those $1 million for everyone who's not related to you, right? And you find funds for them, right? That's a really, right, wild, wild claim. Now, there is discretion because I should make it clear that this is only precedence. Right? This is only precedence. This is not 100%. In fact, Siftet, based on the Gemara in Erevin, lo yitein adam kol tzitkotav ani echad bilvad. It's actually machloket whether this is only true of Truma or Tzedakah, but Shulchan Aruch paskens it's all Tzedakah. You should not give Tzedakah to one person. We want you to diversify. Right? So these are guiding principles, but it's not like once you found the person, right, one person, now you give it to everybody. Right? You're allowed to give and should give to multiple people at different levels in your concentric circle. I remember when I was in high school, it was, what was it, 2003 was the tsunami in Sri Lanka? 2003, something like that? And I remember that my high school raised, I think like many organizations, X number of thousands of dollars for the people in Sri Lanka. And I remember that someone actually wrote an article in the Five Towns Jewish News, or whatever it's called. Whatever,
Five Jewish Times
against the school, and he said, right? He said no, right? The Gemara says aniye, right? Jews, right? Nachri v'ami ami kodem. How could you give them staka? Doesn't the Gemara say that you're supposed to be mifarnes in Yaakov? He says that's only if you've already covered every Jewish person in the world, right? And my principal at the time, Rabbi Friedman, said, what are you talking about? There's a promise that there will always be poor people, right? Obviously, these rules are about precedence, right? Like, majority of allocation. But if there's a pressing need at a particular moment, it's legitimate and even obligatory to respond, right? So these are all about precedence, right? Meaning, who do you give the majority of your funds to? Not all your funds to, right? You're allowed to give with a certain amount of discretion. The Gemara, though, is trying to tell you, when you're allocating your funds, right, how should you divide it? Right, we'll see towards the end that Rabbi Heinemann really attempts to sort of balance all the values in a non-halachic document, but I think a very halachically, shall we say, guided policy document, right? I don't think he claims it's a tshuva, but it's a halachically inspired document. But we'll see that in a few minutes. Sifyud, I won't read inside, but this should be obvious. Sifyud is the rules of precedence apply to your own funds. Right? If you happen to run Temche Shabbos, you can't now say, well, now my relatives get before anybody else, right? It doesn't work that way, right? This is talking about your money, right? Not the money you happen to be in charge of. Okay, good. Now, one of the halachot that sort of complicates this factor, even in the classic literature, right, is that there's one tiny little exception, or gaping exception, as it would be, to this principle, and that is the status of Aniyei Eretz Yisrael. The Sifrei writes, gives precedence on the Eretz Yisrael, but what does that mean? So there's two basic approaches in Poskim. The Bach writes in number 8, Hachitanyas b'Sifrei, v'yoshvei Eretz Yisrael kodmin liyoshvei chutz la'aretz. Sifrei writes that those who live in Israel go before those in chutz la'aretz. V'nir'eh, d'bishneihem mi'ir acheret ka'amar. V'yoshvei Eretz Yisrael kodmin liyoshvei chutz la'aretz. Aval aniyei iro b'chutz la'aretz pshita. V'kodmin la'aniyei ir acheret afilu hem mi'eretz Yisrael. The Bach says the principle of Aniyei Eretz Yisrael only means the following. Your city, Israel, people in Chutz La'aretz, outside of your city. But your city is always first. Your city is always first. He then adds that this includes people who show up in your city but aren't from your city, right? Like people are collecting money in your city, but they're not from your city. Eretz Yisrael, poor people from Eretz Yisrael also get presents over them, right? So if you're in shul and there's two people, neither from your community, asking for money, one's from Eretz Yisrael, one's from Phoenix, I don't know, right? Do we have anyone from Phoenix here? That would be a long commute from the morning, I don't know. Then you would give to the person from Eretz Yisrael. That's the box position. But if you have someone from your hometown and Israel, you still give to your hometown first. The majority of poskim assume not that way. They assume, like Rav Kook in number 9, that ani Eretz Yisrael nikraim gam ken ani ircha. There's an equivalence. Ani Eretz Yisrael are equivalent to the poor of your city. Now, that could be true for one of two reasons. That could either be true because this proves that ani ircha isn't fundamentally geographic. It's about identity. And we're supposed to identify with Eretz Yisrael. Alternatively, this is some halacha that is a manifestation of the notion that everyone really has a place in Israel, so it really is your place, right? So I'm not really sure whether this is a, right, sort of a metaphysical geographic claim, or it's a proof in the identity direction. I don't know. In 10, I won't read it inside, but the Pesachei Tshuva notes from the Chacham Sofer that it's possible that these, that Ani Yerushalayim have precedence over Ani Eretz Yisrael, right? So even within Israel, there's orders of precedence. And as I noted before, right, all of this is complicated by what we see in number 11, which is that you also have to factor in need, right? Chayav lahakdim la'achil ha'ra'av in l'chasod ha'arom, right? You give to people who need food, right? People who are hungry before people who need clothing. And the Panim Yafot assumes, not everyone agrees, but the Panim Yafot in Dvarim assumes that the entire thing we've been talking about, these community-based preferences, are only assuming equal need. But if it's not equivalent need, then you start with the poor who need food, then people with clothing, and then v'chulei. Not everyone agrees to that claim. There has to be some limits on that claim, or there has to be some limits on that claim, because, right, there's always someone starving somewhere, right? You can't, like, track them down and say, therefore I should never give it to people in my city. Yeah.
Do you think your neighborhood, the whole borough, the whole city?
Good. So What do we mean? So this is where we... So now let's try to answer this question. I've raised the possibilities, right? Let's see what Poskim say. And part of that is going to be, well, what do we even mean? Even geographically, what did we mean? So let's see what we mean. So look at 13. So the Gra assumes that what we mean is literally, right? This is just a stand-in, right? You know, we have, right? If you remember, right, people who've learned Erevin, right? You know, right, in Chazal's world, right, they lived in, like, right, these, like, right, chatziros, right, these courtyards that opened into, right, into these alleyways, right, and then they opened up into more alleyways, right, they'd be, right, this would go into another alleyway, into a main street, etc., etc. So the Gra writes that, first of all, we don't just mean, like, city, and that's it. We mean, like, you just keep going in slow, concentric circles, right? The people in your chatzir come first, and the people in your mavui, then the people in the next mavui, then the people, right? It means literally, like, the closer they are to you, the more you give. Again, now, you know, I have no answer to the question of, well, what do we mean, like, to your front door? Do we mean, like, right? Does he literally mean by feet? Does he mean as the crow flies or how long it takes me to walk? All that type of stuff, I have no idea. He means fundamentally, right, there are subunits, right? We don't say, oh, your city is, right, New York, right? We mean, like, your neighborhood, however it's defined, right? You have your sub-neighborhood, right? You have your block, then you have your... Okay. The Shiari Knesset Agdola starts really getting to our question. If you look at 14, he writes, what happened if it's not a city which is divided like this? This is not how people imagine themselves, right? How do people imagine themselves? People imagine themselves, he says, be'ir shem nechlakim lechavurot chavurot u'kilot kilot. What happens if they're not divided like this? They're divided, like I think most of our communities are, into... communities, shuls, right? And I assume some of you have once in your life, or maybe always, daven in the shul that's farther away. There's a you pass another shul on the way, right? I don't know, right? There's a Temani shul next door, right? You daven Ashkenaz, you walk three blocks down, right? Or the shul next door has a 3-hour shacharist, you want an hour and a half shacharist, or vice versa, whatever the case may be, right? Or, right, the one next door has a Karlbach Friday night davening, and you want to finish in a reasonable amount of time, so you go to the one, right, a block, whatever, right, all these things. We know these things happen, right? So he says, what happens if that's the division? Havele kol aniye kihila ukahal kaniye iracheret. He says, the people in the other shul are aniye iracheret, are likely to live in a different city. So what does the Shiari Knesset Agdola come down firmly on the side of? What is the principle of an Yircha? Identification. Right? It's not about where you live. The people in your shul, your community, the people that you've chosen to identify with, you have moral obligations to them first. If you look at the Derech Emunah, Reb Chaim Kanievsky in 15, though, he notes that this is a machloket. He writes, he said, first of all, your neighbors come before other people. And now he says, what does it mean, a neighbor? Yesh omrim d'shcheino nikra imhu ragil etzlo. V'lo mishadar b'shcheinut beito. Some say that what does it mean that someone is your neighbor? It means the person you hang out with, the person you invite to Shabbos meals, the person that you go on vacation with, the people that you talk to, the people that you learn with, not the person who happens to be next door. And then he doesn't even quote anybody in this footnote, so I don't know what to do with this, but maybe it's him, Cholek. V'yesh cholkin. And some people say that's not true. Right? So what does he tell you? He tells you there's a fundamental machloket. Is community defined halachically, geographically? Or when we said ear, that was always a stand-in for community in the social sense, the identity sense. Rav Asher Weiss firmly comes down on the social tie sense. And his argument is not just that community is defined by social ties, but also that the reality is no longer do poor people, and I happen to practically not be sure he's right, just practically speaking. He also claims, as we'll see in just a second, that poor people no longer need their neighbors in the same way, because maybe this is more true in Israel, right? Because they can find someone who will go to America to get support for them. I'm not sure this is true of most poor people, right? Some people, yes.
From
right?
Eretz Yisrael, I think it
From
is.
From Eretz Yisrael, it might be true, right? Eretz Yisrael, but like, I feel like in your average city, right, people really need the support of their local community, right? Like, they're not, no one's advocating for them. In Eretz Yisrael, sure, right? They're like umbrella organizations. We are supporting on the Yerushalayim.
They send people, the people come here.
Right, they come here, and then, look, there are also excellent organizations that do really wonderful work in Eretz Yisrael that they don't have equivalents of here. Like, Leket Yisrael, right, which, right, has come up with the model of not collecting new money, right, but finding resources that already exist, right? Leftovers from the army and catering things and directing the poor people, right? They support many, many people for much cheaper, right? This, right? So there are wonderful organizations that are advocating for Ani Eretz Yisrael. But let's just see what he says. He takes this full throttle and he says, "V'hine av shenatnu haposkim dinekdem k'dima b'tztaka." He said, even though the poskim had given these rules of precedence in staka, yesh litbonen b'matzav ha-mitziyot lefi ha-makom v'azman, you gotta really judge the reality. D'hine barur lefi ani dati, da'af she'amru chazal aniyei ercha kodmin, even though Chazal said, give to the poor of your city, ein ze ela b'mehem, that was only true in the time of Chazal. Shebnei ha'ir him shedagu l'aniyei ram v'zein zulatam yishyedag lehem. Because who else was going to support them? Aval bizmanenu beidan hatachbura vatikshoret hamonit. You got mass transportation and communication. Imani nosei brachvei olam asof trumot. Oh, im vaadot rabbanim v'gufei tzedaka osvim lemano v'persum gadol hachotzeg vulor merchakim. Where everyone is being supported. Definitely in Israel, it's more true, right? The poor people travel, the organizations travel, and they support them in the whole wide world. Shuv einu b'chal ani ercha. Yeah, it's not untrue. He has a point in Israel. Less than thinking Chos Laretz, practically speaking. But Rav Asher takes this position, right, straightforwardly, and he says, look, for practical and maybe moral reasons, Ani Ircha fundamentally is a rule of, it's not about geography anymore, right? It's about something else. Social ties, identification, whatever. But it's not geography, because geography means nothing in the modern world, which I should point out, let me now make a plug to why I think this topic is important, okay? I started at the beginning, but let me do it now. These principles, we're just analyzing one little halacha, right? Staka, okay, not, I don't know, little, right? A big halacha, right? Staka, right? Staka is one of those areas that I think really has been changed, right? Meaning, right, anyone who has Facebook is, I don't know, once a week, there's some, you know, charity.com, causematch.com, right? All these, like, fundraiser things, right? Like, this is a reality in Staka. But these fundamental questions of what does community mean in the modern world affect so many other halachot. So, for example, a shaila that was already raised in tradition like 20 years ago, and then Luchensin raised it in several places, Mar Dasra, right? In the time of Chazal, the halachic authority was the local one, as the Gemara says in Shabbos Kuf Lamed. Who is your Mardasra nowadays? Is it your local rabbi? Let's say you are a Yekka who has moved out of Washington Heights, right? Can you still follow Yekka Minhagim, right? Yekkish Minhagim? The answer is probably yes, but that's a claim that community on a halachic level has been defined identity-wise and not geography, or ethnically, as it were, right? Rav Asher Weiss happens to be a fan of this in general. He has tshuvot to give you an idea of how many different types of area this affects. He asks, okay, how do you define prices, bizmanazef, the purposes of ona'a? Right, you're not allowed to overcharge. Well, good. How do you define prices in a globalized world? And you know what Rav Asher's answer is? Kedarko? You can't. There's no such thing as ona'a, bizmanazef. There is no price control because you buy it in China, it's 10 cents. Right, you buy it in the Upper East Side, it's $75. Right, it's literally the same thing. Right? With certain exceptions. He's like, okay, milk in Israel, which is price controlled and it's perishable and whatever, okay, right? He's like, certain things, fine. But fundamentally, right, the reality of global commerce, global communication, global travel makes it that all these halachot that were geography based, right, disappear. Yeah?
Does halachot make any distinction between those who are poor because never they're poor and those who are poor by choice? If I choose not to go to college, that's
what so the short answer is it's a machlokes, uh-huh. But as a Talmud of Rav Lichtenstein, I will say firmly, yes, it does. Rav Lichtenstein wrote an article, I don't remember how many years ago, but it's been translated, it's claiming based on the Kliyakar that yes, right, that there is less obligation to an ani who chooses to be poor rather than someone who's, right, who's nebuch, poor.
Even if it's for learning's sake.
Doesn't matter, yes. Right? Yeah. Okay. But this, so this is one possibility. But the other possibility we saw is to say, no, it's all about geography. But remember I said before, maybe, it really depends. What type of stuck are you talking about? Right? There are certain stuckas that should be identity, ideological, social, and certain ones that, because we want to take care of the people who are the least enfranchised, right, the most disenfranchised to begin with, it should be geographic, right? Right? To put it in the most sort of straightforward way. A soup kitchen, right, should be in a physical place, right? It shouldn't be, right, like you have a digital soup kitchen, right, where you can, right, you can, like, sign up and they will then send you an email, oh, this is where you can go to find food, right? Like, that's not how these things work, right? So, right, Heinemann, in a really fascinating document, really fascinating, Turchino once showed this to me years ago. It is online, but no longer really. You have to go to the Wayback Machine on archive.org if you want to find it, but I put it here for you. And here is here was his practical suggestion. This comes back to, was it Cy? No, Cy was in front of you. Well, you're Dave's point about discretion. He tries to integrate the value of discretion, right? You don't give to one person. You do have a certain autonomy with the reality that certain stucco are best given in Aniyerach on the geographic sense, with the reality that certain things are about moral, social ties. And he tries to bring those all together. And again, I don't think this is a psak, but I think this is a very sensitive, halachically inspired policy document that I think really does a fascinating job at bringing all these values together. So let's just read what he writes. In allocating and dispersing tzedakah funds, one should divide the amount of tzedakah into thirds. The first one-third should be given to needy individuals or institutions in town. A second third should be used to satisfy one's moral obligations, whether they be in town or elsewhere. In the event that one's moral obligations are all in town, then at least two-thirds of one's tzedakah would be distributed in the Baltimore area. The final third may be given to any qualified individual or institution, including those out of town, provided that the requirement stated above of assuring that over 50% of one's tzedakah be distributed in town has been satisfied. Right? This is like him very much trying to say, look, this is true, this is true, right? There's room for discretion. There's people who should be supported simply because they're in your community, because they're just poor and they need food. There's institutions that you owe to because you believe in them. You have moral obligations to them, social obligations to them, and when you give tzedakah, there is a level of discretion, but these are guiding principles that will make sure that you're yotzei zayin everything, right? A little bit of everything that you keep in the spirit of these very complicated, right, guiding principles. Not like hard and fast rules. These are principles, right? Like, you should take these into account when you allocate funds. His next paragraph is actually really fascinating. He says, so what counts as moral obligations? This, I think, is just... So he says, a needy relative or close friend. That we know, right? That's classic literature. Then he says something very interesting. A mosad in which you, your spouse, or your children received a Torah education without paying full tuition. Right? Which is, I think, a very interesting, very halakhically inspired, right? And clearly in the spirit of this sugya, claim, right? Meaning someone who you actually took, right? Someone... However you want to view tuition, right, as tzedakah or simply the recognition not everyone can pay. The point is, you were in a situation where you couldn't pay full tuition, and someone else in that institution wants to benefit from the same thing you did, and now you're in a position to help. He says, that's called, right, a moral obligation, right? That is, and I think there's a lot, right, there's a lot of truth to what he says there. Then he says, a mosad, or needy individual from which you have direct benefit, right? Because they're the moral obligation is, right, created by the fact that I benefit from them. And then a mosad owned or directed by a relative or close friend to whom you feel a responsibility to help. Now, you could quibble here, there. Right? Again, I don't know if this is a psak. I don't know. Right? There weren't makaros in this document. But I think what you see here at Heinemann doing is, right, saying there's a level at which staka really should be geographic. There's a level at which it's about moral obligations, about... And all of those are true. And while in some areas you might want to totally abandon the geographic model, in tzedakah you don't want to abandon it, but you don't want to deny the reality that we also define community now along identity lines. So his solution is a little bit of this and a little bit of that, which I think is a brilliant attempt at highlighting the complexity of this issue in the modern world. Now, if you go, I should have noted, this fell up, from the next paragraph, from Rabbi Heinemann's argument, that's not Rabbi Heinemann anymore, that was me in the article I wrote where I quoted it, which is at the end if you want to see sort of more on it. I don't need to read myself, but it's there. Okay. Reich Harlap actually had a middle position, and I know nothing more about the position than what I put here. I checked with the Reich Feldman, who quotes it in his book, if he knows anything more. He said, no, I walked into Reich Harlap. Anyone knows Reich Harlap? This makes sense. I walked into Reich Harlap's office one day. We were schmoozing Torah. He told me this. This is all that exists. So this is all that exists, okay? But in 18, I'm sure if you see Reich Harlap, you can ask him. Reich Harlap has suggested another factor that may in modern times divert emphasis away from Ani Ircha and in favor of Aniye Eretz Israel. The increasing development of the global village has, through technological advances, both diluted the significance of those in immediate geographic proximity while enhancing the connection to faraway donors, those living in Israel. Right? Reich Harlap claimed that he wasn't willing to sort of wholesale abandon notions of geography. What he was willing to do is say that maybe even according to the Bach, who thought that your local poor have precedence over on the Eretz Israel, that would shift now, right? Because it's not that local community doesn't mean anything. It just doesn't mean quite what it used to mean. And therefore that, like, right, that balance of Ani Ircha come a little bit before Ani Eretz Israel, that might shift because, right, the world is a little bit less geographically aligned and a little bit more identity aligned. That is like another sort of compromise position here, but again, highlights the complexity. We have 2 minutes, so let me summarize the last three sources here outside. There is one more element in Staka, and that is, all of this is in terms of allocation, right? Like, I realize I have X number of thousands of dollars that I, between Meister and money that I have that's extra, and however you want to define those numbers, then I have to allocate, right? So I sit there, right, it's December 27th, right, I have a few days left to the tax year, I'm just sitting there, okay, how much money can I give, blah, 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 and get a tax receipt for this year, okay? But there is one more principle, and this is one of those things that guides much of what we do in it, is that there's another obligation, and that is when you are faced with a poor person and a need, Torah never wants you to be apathetic, right? And therefore, there is a prohibition that if a poor person asks you for money, you don't start cheshbonning out, assuming it's a real poor person, you don't have reason to believe they're not, etc., sugya in and of itself. But someone asks you for money, you don't say, well, I owe my friends, I owe my community. No, right? There's a prohibition to ever show apathy. So the very, right, this is all like when I'm allocating funds. That principle, though, that you must respond to that which you see doesn't just appear in staka, right? In the Gemara in Bava Metzia tells you that in terms of the mitzvot of loading and unloading animals, you become obligated when you see it from a close distance, right? And Rabbi Turchiner, in the last source here I gave you, notes that what that seems to tell you is that this is a principle, not just in staka. It's a principle in chesed, right? That in addition to all sort of these, you know, very complicated analyses that we've been going through, who counts, etc., right? There is also a level of all of chesed where if I encounter something, I'm supposed to respond. Because in addition to the consequentialist, utilitarian component of tzedakah, right, there's a virtue part, right? I'm supposed to be a good person. And if I'm faced with a need, I have to give something. I have to do something, right? We want you to respond, right? We don't want you just to sit back and calculate and based on all your obligations, however you understand them. There is also that element, right? Now, in the modern world, that's interesting because, right, sometimes, like in the case that I brought before from the tsunami, you feel that pull, right, to something that's a million miles away, right? But halacha wants you to respond, right? Halacha never wants you to be apathetic. And one of the things that's changed in this world of mass communication is that you feel that pull to people that you never would have before, which is yet another thing that I think you have to think about when you think about how the world has changed. I hope that this year has just given you an idea of the type of thing that I think we need to think about. Because, like I said, halacha guides us in every aspect of our life. And if our lives are changed completely and are changing faster and faster by the increase in communication and transportation, etc., then we really need to take a moment, right, and look at halacha and say, well, what is halacha's guidance in this new world? And I said, this is true in staka, it's true in who's your mar d'asra, it's true in, I don't remember what examples I gave, right? But I think this is just an example of the type of work we need to do in halachic analysis if we want halacha to speak to our world, which changes faster and faster. And when you look back at the sources, you realize that asking what was halacha after and what will that look like in a modern world is actually quite instructive in helping us integrate Torah's values and applying them to the complexities of the modern world. So that's my that's one example. Go ahead.